Welcome to episode 5 of the 8-part Harvey Hunt series on the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we follow Marine Corporal Harvey Hunt as he fights across 4 island battlefields of the Pacific during World War II. In episode 4, we heard more about Harvey's recovery from his battlefield wound on Tinian. Join us now as Harvey prepares for the invasion of Iwo Jima. This is the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we're going to feature interviews that were collected, conducted by Ryan Fairfield and myself, Tony Lupo, for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. The focus of this podcast is not going to be on world leaders or events that led to World War II. It's not going to be about general strategy. It's going to be about the everyday GI soldiers and their experience. Welcome to our journey. So this is the end of the segment where Harvey had a chance to recover from his wounds that he suffered in Tinian. And just look at the timeline real quick. So that would have happened on July 27th. And the next action that he's going to be trained for is Iwo Jima, which the landing date for that was February 19th of 1945. He made it to Hawaii around the 1st of October. So between the 1st of October until Iwo Jima is about 5 months. So he was recuperating from his wounds for several months, and he had a chance to get reintegrated into his unit, get reinforcements. The units got reconstituted. He talks about getting a promotion to fire team leader, and so The next segment is going to talk about his preparation, his journey to Iwo Jima, and then the invasion landing itself.
When I got back to Maui, they immediately started training for Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. And this time we boarded an AKA, which is a personnel ship, troop ship, instead of an LST, mm-hmm. because those LSTs made about 4 knots. And when you're going 6,000 miles, that's forever.
Yes.
Didn't have any shower accommodations. No, you know, you had to sleep under the LSTs or LCTs.
Yeah, so just a quick message here. What he's talking about is the AKA, and he mentions the distances, 6,000 miles and 4 knots. And I already did the math for you. If you're going 4 knots and 6,000 miles, it's going to take you about 54 days. So the AKA, and believe me, this is just for the transports. I mean, the destroyers, the carriers, everything else could go well in excess of 20 knots. Some of them could touch 30 knots, which would greatly reduce the amount of time needed to move from place to place. So the AKA was a type of ship I was not familiar with. The first time I heard this interview, and then when I re-listened to it, this podcast, I never heard of it. So I did a quick research on it, and it stands for an assault cargo ship. So this assault cargo ship, they started making them in 1943. They made 108 of them specifically for the Pacific. Try saying that 3 times. And this ship was a true warship. It wasn't a Liberty ship loaded down with supplies that they dropped off on a beach like they did for Guadalcanal. This was a proper warship. It had oversized hatches and hulls. It had weaponry. It was survivable. Several of these were torpedoed during the war. None of them were ever sank. It could carry more men. And it had a combat information center, a place where they could communicate with sophisticated communication methods at the time, whatever was available, and their own radars, to get a much better view of the battlefield they were traveling in. And then they were faster. So what you heard Harvey say, and I think he'll mention it again later in Iwo, is these AKAs were much better ships. They were more comfortable. They could fit more men.
Better meals.
Yeah, they were proper warships, and yeah. that's what you heard him mention.
And on board the AKA, you got 2 meals a day. You got breakfast at about 10 o'clock, and about 4 o'clock you got sandwiches, which was better than what we had on the LST, because there you got all dried potatoes, dried eggs, whatever they can dry. That's what you ate. No fresh fruit or anything.
So the means and mode of transport has improved considerably.
Had a lot to do with the way you lived, yeah. And we left Maui, let's see, that would have been about mid-December. Well, no, it had been before that, probably the last part of November we left for Iwo Jima.
Did you know you were leaving for Iwo Jima when you left Maui?
They tell you after you leave port, you don't know it.
Until you get on ship.
Yeah, they don't ever tell you until you're aboard ship. We got to Saipan Tinian while they anchored for about 2 weeks, I guess, while they gather all their forces, including the battleships and everything. And in the meantime, while the carriers, or the, at that time it's the old Halsey's outfit, they were bombing Iwo Jima and Japan. They were going after them. And when they pulled anchor, they were building the B-29 strips. And we were anchored and we could see the B-29s taking off.
And what was your impression of that? I mean, that was a pretty
technical airplane
for that day.
That's a huge airplane.
Yeah.
Anyway, they would take off this one after the other. Must have been 1,200 B-29s on Saipan, Tinian, and Guam, some of the three islands they occupied. And when we landed on Saipan, as soon as we took the first airfield, the Navy CBs came in right behind us. Mm. Even though they got shelled down then, they came in and started moving that dirt and building that airstrip. And the same thing on Tinian. As soon as you got that airstrip, they were in there. Mm. And but when they were taking off, while we were still anchored, one of them exploded. They were taking off in twos, and one of them exploded right on the runway.
Wow.
Just whoom, you know.
Wow.
So I had a little respect for those airmen.
Yeah.
Seeing that happen to them.
How did you feel when you came back, you're gearing up for the Iwo Jima invasion, and you're seeing the fruits of what you had fought for? You had invaded those islands, and now you're seeing, wow, look at this. The runway, look at all these planes, and, you know, how'd that impact?
We told them they were lucky.
Mm. Yeah.
That's the way we felt about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it hadn't been for us, they wouldn't have been able to do it.
Yeah,
that's one thing that, looking at the big picture of the Pacific Theater, we talk about, everyone says that Midway was a big turning point in the Pacific campaign, and it was. But Saipan was also that. We talked about that at the beginning of the Saipan segment, where the commander from the Imperial Japanese Army, he knew he had orders from Japan from Tokyo not to let the island fall. And when it fell, and he explained to his troops, if we lose this island, we will lose the war. And it wasn't hyperbole at the time. I mean, they understood that the Americans had planes that had the range to get to Tokyo, to get to Japan from Saipan. They had to hold that island. And so, I just want to kind of point out, this is one of the things that, and I think Tony has some more to say on this, but this is one of those things where, you know, Harvey has seen some real history. This guy had had a front row to real history happening across the Pacific.
Yeah, every war has, you know, a turning point or turning points. And in the Pacific, the Battle of Midway is often, you know, ascribed as the turning point in the Pacific, primarily because after Midway, the Japanese were always on the defensive. Prior to that, they were always on the offensive. But a lot of historians think that the Marianas Operation Forager, was the real turning point in the Pacific. Because of what you just said, they had the ability to take land-based bombers and bomb the Japanese homeland. And for example, Ian Toll, in his book, The Conquering Tide, he writes, and I'm quoting this now, he said that though the Americans were slow to appreciate it, they had just won the decisive victory of the Pacific War. the capture of the Marianas and the accompanying ruin of the Japanese carrier air power were the final and irreversible blows to the hopes of the Japanese imperial project. And what he means by the air power was while the Marianas campaign was going on to capture those islands, the Japanese fleet, the primary strike force, moved to disrupt the invasion beaches and push the invaders off these islands. As Ryan had said, no figure less than the emperor himself recognized the importance of the Marianas to the defense of Japan. And they sortied a fleet that was 50% larger than the one that attacked Pearl Harbor to stop the invasion. Mm-hmm. But at this point in the war, the Americans had overwhelming superiority and firepower.
Well, and then at the same time as the Saipan Tinian Island invasions was the Marianas Turkey Shoot.
Well, that's what I'm referring to right now.
Okay.
The Marianas Turkey Shoot was when the Japanese fleet moved to disrupt these invasion beaches. They were intercepted by Task Force 58 and basically lost their entire air arm. There was over 300 Japanese planes lost to, you know, depending on the numbers, 25 to 50 of our own, some of those by operational accidents. There was only, the Marianas Turkey Shoot was so lopsided that there was one battle which is described as the worst naval air slaughter in the history of warfare, where 12 Hellcats jumped 60 Japanese bombers and shot them all down in 15 minutes. And this was going on everywhere in the Marianas. They lost their brand new carrier, the Japanese, an American submarine, the Taiho. This armored deck carrier was sank by American submarines. Other ships were sunk, but the main thing that the Japanese lost in the Marianas Turkey Shoot was their carrier air power. The cream of it was lost in Coral Sea and Midway, and the rest of it was lost in the Marianas. From that point on, because of the Marianas Turkey Shoot and the battle for Saipan, Tinian, and Guam, the Americans, and I'm quoting from Ian Toll's book again, the Americans had demonstrated that they would win or could win Dominion of the Skies anywhere in the Pacific with carrier air power alone. Didn't even need land bases anymore. Task Force 58 alone had 15 aircraft carriers.
Wow.
And that wasn't even the carrier task force in the South that was supporting Douglas MacArthur, mm-hmm. or the one in supporting the landings and anti-submarine efforts in the Atlantic Theater. It was amazing. They could leap, and I'm quoting again from Ian Toll's book, that they could leap across long ocean distances to invade well-defended continental land masses. And that the naval, air, amphibious juggernaut could move faster and farther. We talked about these purpose-built ships to go faster, like the AKAs. They could move faster and farther than the enemy had imagined possible. And so here is a quote from Admiral Nomura that he shared with interrogators after the war about what the Americans were able to do in the Central Pacific. He said, and this is a quote from this admiral, "Everywhere, I think, you attacked before the defense was ready. You came far more quickly than we expected." So what he's saying is because of these new task forces that we put together and this amphibious juggernaut, they were never ready. Every time we met them, we got there quicker, more quickly than they could anticipate, and we just overwhelmed them. Basically, the Americans had developed the capability to project overwhelming force into distant frontiers in the Western Pacific, and no tactical masterstroke or blunder, any mistake on our part, could reverse the increasingly lopsided balance of power between the combatants. So what you're hearing Harvey saying right here was he recognized, even at that time, that what they did was a big deal. It mattered. I think a lot of people, including myself, didn't really see the Marianas battle as being the turning point, but Ian Toll makes a fantastic argument for being the battle that really, truly turned the tide in the war. And that B-29 that he saw Another little factoid. This comes from the book from Donald Miller, The Story of World War II. This is from an eyewitness account on Saipan after the invasion, after the Seabees had built these runways for these B-29s, over 1,000 that would operate in this area. He quoted, quote, "None of us had ever seen a B-29," he wrote in his diary. "So all hands were on the lookout for the first one to land on Saipan. And Sanders was there when the first B-29 landed. The name of it was Jolting Josie." It touched down, and here was, and he was there when Possum Hansel's crew took off on their first bombing raid to Tokyo. So he's writing about the very first B-29 to land on the island was Jolting Josie, and then they were there to watch the very first B-29s take off and bomb Tokyo. Truly a turning point. And, you know, they paid for it in blood, but man, what an important battle that he was a part of.
Did you get a feeling at that point that, did you have any thoughts that we'd lose the war?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, never had any thought. There's a lot of people in the service, and I know people that were out of the service, but I had a friend who was, is my fire team leader. Before we ever went into combat, he said, "I'm not going to live through that first time." He said, "I'm not going to live." And he wanted me to be sure that his parents got all of his personal possessions. And I said, "Oh, that's nonsense." And he said, no, he said, "It's going to happen." And as I said, you know, he no more than got ashore and was killed instantly. Hmm. And we had another guy, his name was Abel. And we, on Saipan, we were all sitting around, kind of regrouping and discussing what was going to do next. And he was sitting on his helmet, leaning against a tree, and he said, "You know, I'm not going to get off of this island." And by gosh, he got killed. And I've discussed that with a number of people. I had a friend in a little town I graduated high school in, Warren, Oklahoma. Ewell Underdown is his name, and before he ever went overseas, he was in the Army. He said, "I'm not going to come back from Europe." He said, and he did. So something about that I've talked to the minister about that, and he has no answer, but my wife, I think, has probably the best answer. She says that's the Holy Spirit telling them, you know, be prepared.
So we've had a chance to talk to a number of vets about this particular issue, and it's us trying to make sense of a situation where death is everywhere around you, and men who were more highly trained than you or were leaders that you looked up to died right away, and other people who were, you know, green, new to combat, didn't experience, would survive the island campaign. What I can't understand is why every sailor or every soldier didn't feel this way. I actually can understand why someone would sit on their helmet by a tree and say, "I'm not going to make it off this island after seeing death everywhere around you." I think you could flip the script a little bit and say, what was it about so many American GIs that gave them the hope or the idea that they were the ones that were going to survive this, or that they never contemplated the idea that we would lose the war, or that they would be the ones that would quote unquote get it?
Yeah, you know, and we talked about this in our first series with on Alan Sr. about this, you know, this thought that everyone had that seemed to permeate at least the youth, that we would never lose this war. You know, it's amazing to me that, you know, and Harvey seeing it, you know, on the front, maybe that's why he felt that way. Maybe he just saw all the ordnance and he saw the industrial might of this country and was like, there's no way, you know, that chain of islands in the west side of the Pacific was going to be able to stop our country, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, you know, this sort of thing, you know, he talks about these guys essentially having these premonitions or foreseeing their own death sort of thing. You know, in Sledge's book, With the Old Breed at Peleliu in Okinawa, He touches on that very same thing. He was in the Marine Corps also and fought, you know, took a different path throughout the Pacific. But he talks about in that book that at one point they were all sitting around like, you know, a campfire or whatever it was they were around. And he said it was like someone whispered into his ear and said, "You're going to survive."
Mm-hmm.
And he said he talked about other guys having these premonitions. But for whatever reason, he had a voice that entered his head that told him the opposite. And so there's something to this. There's something cosmic here. You know, it's you know, the Holy Spirit talking to these individuals.
Well, it was important enough for him to talk to his pastor about it.
Yeah.
It was important enough for him to talk to other veterans about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was important enough for people to include that in the books that they have written.
Right.
So yeah, there's something there.
All right. So, you know, a lot of times when we're doing these interviews with these veterans, we're using these mini DV camcorders, and each of these tapes, you know, has an hour, you know, 60 to 62 minutes worth of time on this. The interview just ended, tape one just ended, and I'm scrambling to switch tapes.
Yeah.
And as always happens in these interviews, these guys keep talking, and usually it's really compelling stuff at
yes.
this point. And so he's now talking about all these guys he knew that got wounded, and they get taped up and sent back to the front.
And he's talking about, while you're changing tape, you're not recording this. And this is something that happens to us so much. Either at the start of an interview, they'll just start telling us stuff, and we're like, well, hold on, let's get the cameras going. Or if we're switching tapes, which happens here, they'll do it. And then at the end, one of the things that we learned is if we have an hour's worth of tape and we go, say, 40 minutes into it, I know me, used to just turn the tape off because I thought the interview's over. We stopped doing that. We're like, we're going to run tape.
You've got the tape. Let it go.
Yeah, just
if
let it go.
You got any room left, because there's a lot of good stuff that comes out after they get done telling their story.
Yes, after they're quote-unquote off camera. And so what we're going to do now is we asked Harvey at the start of the second tape to kind of reiterate some of the things that he was telling us while we were switching tapes. And so you're going to hear some anecdotes before we get into the invasion of Iwo Jima proper about some of the experiences he had on Saipan and other islands.
Gosh.
I had a friend from Virginia, and he got shot. He was crawling. We were crawling. He was in my squad. We were crawling along the ground, and the guy behind him had taken the safety off of his rifle.
Oh.
And he's crawling along with this rifle, and he shot old my friend through the foot.
Oh,
and up the leg, just ricocheted right up the shin bone. He got sent stateside. When he came back, we were getting ready for the invasion of Japan. And by then, I was a squad leader. And one night I woke up and I could hardly breathe. It was just a heavy weight on me. And the cotton picker was sitting on my chest. He'd been sent back to the same unit. And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he said, "If I was going to have to go in combat again, I wanted to come back to F Company."
That's just amazing. You know, look, this guy, I can't imagine this injury. Getting shot with, I assume, a .30-06.
Oh,
can
yeah.
you imagine?
No.
Having it come in through the bottom of his foot, probably his heel, and going right up through his shin and everything. And then he goes stateside, probably thinking he got the million-dollar wound. Nope. You're back. Right back over there. Getting ready to invade Japan, no less.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, we see the numbers that we quote for people who get wounded on these various campaigns, and you just wonder what percentage of them got wounded through things like this. I mean, everyone's jacked up. They're getting shot at. They're highly weaponized. These sort of things happened a lot more than we'd like to admit.
All right. So now we're getting into the last island invasion that Harvey is going to have to participate in the war. It's the invasion of Iwo Jima. Everybody's heard of Iwo Jima. You've seen the movie Letters from Iwo Jima, Flags of Our Fathers. It's, you know, hallowed ground for the Marine Corps. But, you know, it's part of the Volcano Islands chain. It was spaced equidistant between the Japanese home islands and the Marianas, which we had just captured, Saipan and Tinian. So it was considered to be a great strategic position to capture. as potentially a staging ground for the invasion of Japan, which we would all knew was going to be coming eventually, as well as a great place for B-29s, basically a floating impregnable aircraft carrier. And in addition to that, there was a radar installation on Iwo Jima that could relay, could see the B-29s as they're flying over to Japan to attack and to do the bombing of the cities. So that radar station would give Tokyo a heads up. And so that was an early warning system, so we wanted to try to get that taken care of also. That wasn't worth invading the island for, but these are all good reasons to try to take Iwo Jima.
Yeah, I'd like to add a little more to that. So I think a common narrative for Iwo Jima is we invaded it so we could have a landing strip for disabled B-29s flying back from bombing Japan. So they would fly out of Saipan, they would fly out of Tinian, they would bomb Japan, they would fly over Iwo Jima, and with Iwo Jima in enemy hands, they could be attacked from aircraft from Iwo Jima and surrounding islands. So that's one reason why you'd want to eliminate it. Another was as the B-29s came back, they'd have to fly the gauntlet of more fighters again. Mm-hmm. And if they had any sort of mechanical issues, they'd have to ditch in the water. So the common narrative is that we did it just so the B-29s had a place to land on the way back. But there was actually more to it than that. And I didn't realize it until I was doing research for this podcast. It turns out that Admiral Nimitz did not want to invade Iwo Jima. He knew it was a fortified position. He knew it'd be a costly fight. And he wasn't too enthused about doing it. But what was happening, and this is something I did not know, is after we invaded and secured Saipan, Tinian, and Guam, and were launching bomber raids on Japan, the Japanese were flying off these other islands like Iwo Jima, Chichijima, and whatnot, with their own fighter, and they were bombing and strafing our B-29 fortresses on Saipan. And in fact, in this book from Donald L. Miller, The Story of World War II, he writes, and I quote, toward dusk, several Japanese planes suddenly swooped low over Isley Field and proceeded to bomb and strafe the Park Super Forts. The enemy pilots were audacious. They were only 50 feet off the runway, and they took us by surprise and left the field littered and with burned and blasted B-29s. In fact, even though the raid stopped in December, just before we invaded Iwo because of some heavy losses by the Japanese, the enemy bombers destroyed more B-29s on the ground, on Saipan, from places like Iwo Jima, than we lost in the air over Japan.
That's amazing.
I did not know that. I figured once we secured Saipan and Tinian that it was just my blue heaven, that we just launched bombers and the only source of friction we had was over the island of Japan or maybe Iwo Jima. What this is saying is that we were losing more bombers to these ground action, these ground attacks than on the air. And that, they said, is what prompted Nimitz to say, we're going to go forward with Iwo Jima. So this narrative of Iwo Jima, was it necessary? Should we have done it? It was just for the B-29s is not true. There were a lot of strategic reasons why it made sense to take this island.
And what an inhospitable island it was.
Oh.
An active volcano, devoid of life, no fresh water source on the island. It was a truly inhospitable place. I can only imagine being one of these poor guys in the Imperial Japanese Army that is stationed there. They constructed 11 miles of tunnels underground. Mm. Can you imagine that duty? I mean, you talk about hard labor. You're essentially a slave digging in this hot mountain. You know, we hear Harvey talk later about the fact that they couldn't even lay down on the ground because it was so hot. They had to put their blankets down and that sort of thing. Just a miserable place. The 11 miles of tunnels that they had constructed underground connected 1,500 rooms that they had underground, which consisted of hospitals, artillery emplacements, bunkers, ammo dumps, fighting positions. And that having this enabled the Imperial Japanese Army to fire from a concealed location, and it would maximize the impact on U.S. forces.
Yeah, Donald Miller writes in his book that the cave defenses were stocked with weapons, fuel, rations, and all of them had a myriad of secret entrances and exits. And you're going to hear Harvey talk about the problems that caused as they advanced along the island. They never knew where the enemy was. Mm-hmm. They never They couldn't take any comfort in the fact that once they eliminated a position, it was truly eliminated. It would come active again because these positions, when they were threatened, the Japanese could sneak easily through the tunnels to the next one below it or behind the original position,
yeah,
surprising the Marines with exterminating counterfire, as he writes. And over the entrances of these tunnels and caves, Kiribayashi built double-layered concrete blockhouses and pillboxes, which were concealed by volcanic ash. So only the gun muzzles were exposed. Suribachi itself, right? Mount Suribachi, yeah, the volcano that dominates the landscape for Iwo Jima, itself had seven levels of tunnels connecting almost 1,000 gun galleries.
My goodness.
Yeah. This... this is some medieval stuff here.
It was truly a fortress.
Yes, it was.
You know, and Kiribayashi, who was the Lieutenant General Tadamichi Kiribayashi, was the commander of the island. He took a different tact and basically bucked, Tokyo and the military command in Tokyo. Instead of meeting the Americans on the beaches, as had been done in every previous battle, he knew he wanted to take this island campaign, this defense of the island, underground. And so that's why he devoted all of his attention to below ground emplacements and making that the fortress. He wanted every square inch of the island. He wanted every possible location on the island covered by Japanese fire. So as these guys like Harvey moved inland, you know, you think, you know, you get to a certain point, you can look back, you've taken so much real estate, you know, oh, we've moved in 1,000 yards. Well, that may not be the case. You might have a guy pop up behind you from a tunnel and start shooting at you from behind. So they had to worry about this all the time. So Kiribayashi opted to go underground, as I mentioned, which led to a drawn out, horrific battle. And for the first time, inflicted more casualties on the U.S. than were inflicted on the Japanese forces. Prior to this point, you know, the Japanese died, 2 to 3 times the rate that Americans, you know, had casualties inflicted. This time, it would be different. The grand result that Kiribayashi was actually hoping for with this, you know, very strong, impregnable fortress that he was building was to damage U.S. spirits to the point that we would pull back and maybe it would buy some more time for Japan to prepare for what they knew was coming, which was the invasion of Japan. The pre-invasion bombardment, which had always worked so well on the other islands, Saipan and Tinian and Roy Namur, was not as effective this time. And you can imagine why. They had a three-day bombardment, where they actually wanted a 10-day bombardment. It only got a three-day bombardment. It begs to the question whether or not that extra 7 days really might have helped much, because this Japanese army was underground the entire time. So well dug in, the black sand beaches, which consisted of volcanic ash and cinders, was much more difficult to negotiate than they had planned. These dunes on the beaches were 15 feet high. And because of the nature of the beaches, guys would come ashore and they'd sink up to their knees in the sand. It was very loosely and consolidated. And some of these Amtraks and tanks that would come ashore would just churn into the sand and sink right there. And that was part of the plan from Kiribayashi. He knew that we would have a hard time coming aboard and negotiating these beaches right off the bat. So he waited, he lie in wait, until the beaches became clogged with men and material. And that's when he held back and he actually unleashed his artillery on us at that point to maximize the damaging effect.
Yeah, so the United States rolled in there with the Task Force 58 with 600 to 800 warships and transports, 70,000 troops. So it was a smaller operation than the Marianas. But it was only thought that there was 13,000 Japanese defenders, and it turned out there would be almost twice that number that faced them. So we had the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Marine Divisions. Their job was to take this heavily defended island with only 13,000 Japanese defenders, and again, that ended up not being true. And these clips that you're about to hear are Harvey's experience as a member of this invasion force.
So we kind of got off on a tangent, but we were taught you're on Saipan at this point. You've recovered from your wound and you're gearing up for the invasion of Okinawa.
Well, we went from
Iwo Jima,
Saipan on the AKA, to Iwo. And when we got to Iwo, we disembarked from the AKA and got aboard an LST, because that's where those amphibs are, you know, that's where they keep those. And spent the night on the LST, and then got aboard our amphib at about this February the 19th. And I didn't sleep much that night before, because we didn't get aboard the cotton picking the LST till 10 o'clock or something. And the time we got fed and everything, then they got us up at 5 o'clock. And we got our meal and went down and got aboard the amphib. And have you ever been aboard an LST?
No.
Well, it's just a big hollow ship. And it'll hold probably 8-10 tanks, maybe more. It's a big ship or big carrier. And they fire those engines up. And boy, you wonder if you're going to survive breathing all that carbon monoxide. I don't think that they had fans, but it didn't in their airplane engines. And I don't know whether they took good care of them or not, but I'll tell you, that was the smokiest place you could ever be in. So they, as soon as they get in a position, they open the ramp and you just drive off of this ramp into the water, and it's gotten big and amphib just nosedive. You wonder whether it's going to come up or not. And then you rendezvous, they call it, and you just go in a circle until everybody gets off of their ships and gets in line. Then they head towards the beach. You don't know where you're going into the beach. We're receiving fire. They had a 77 millimeter high velocity, similar to the 88 the Germans had. And they were firing at us, but they hit one of those amphibs that, you know, bobbing up and down the sea. They weren't having much luck. I didn't see any of them get hit. And we rolled that thing up on the beach. It didn't have any obstacles on the shore. The only thing, the Navy SEALs may have taken them out, I don't know, but we didn't run into any obstacles. And they drove up on the beach and we piled out. And Captain Padley was right in front of me. And we were getting a lot of artillery and mortar fire. And I thought they'd thrown in a gas round. And I said to Padley, Captain Padley, I said, I think that's gas. And he said, Hunt, we got enough trouble without you offering gas.
Now you talk about like mustard gas? Like
any kind. They had about three or four different kinds, but it can be delivered by artillery shells.
Yeah.
And
of course, then he didn't want everyone to have to put their gear on.
Well, everything. you had this gas mask on, you know. And you got so much gear that if you ever fell down in the, you know, or fell off of one of those amphibs into the ocean, you would sink like a lead sinker.
Well, when the ramp dropped, what did you see? What did it look like?
You just see hundreds and hundreds of ships and little boats and planes diving in and strafing and dropping bombs.
How far off from the beach are you when you come out of the LST?
Probably 3 miles.
What about when the Amtrak finally landed on the beach? What was the scene like there?
We're the first ones there.
So the beach wasn't clogged up at this point.
There wasn't anybody there but us, you know.
So, yeah, I mean, like I mentioned before, Harvey has a front row seat to history here. You know, there's a lot to talk about with that very long clip we just played there. But one of the things he talks about is how it was cleared of obstacles. He talked about maybe the Navy SEALs taking care of that.
Yeah, and the Navy SEALs didn't exist then. They were the frogmen / UDT or underwater demolition teams, which became Navy SEALs after World War II. These were the precursors to the Navy SEALs, which did these really dangerous missions. And in fact, I didn't really appreciate what these frogmen, they were called back then, actually did and how they did it. and when they did it. So from Donald L. Miller's book, I'm going to read just a couple of excerpts that talks about what these frogmen did. And after I read this, I was absolutely dumbfounded at the bravery of these men. So in an interview given long after the war, there's a frogman named Andy Anderson, and he describes the work of the men who were known as half fish and half nuts. And he said, "I'll never forget when we first arrived in the waters off Iwo Jima on D-3, means 3 days before the invasion, right? And he stood on the deck and looked at the island, and it was, as he describes it, the most godforsaken place he'd ever seen. He said it had rising smoke and haze and that frightening-looking volcano, which was Suribachi, and it flashed through his mind that this would be a great place to film a Dracula movie. And we all thought, quote, why do we want that miserable piece of real estate? So it reinforces this idea that even the ground that they were fighting on was literally hellacious. And their job as frogmen was to swim to the invasion beaches, locate mines and detonate them, and look for other beach obstacles, which is what Harvey intimates when they're arriving on the beach, that there were no obstacles, and he felt like the frogmen, the SEALs, cleared it for him. They also had to bring back samples of the sand to see if their landing vehicles could operate in that brown volcanic ash. And this is something I did not know. The operation had to be done in daylight, not at night. I thought they would go under the cover of darkness, but they did it in the daylight to make sure that they got all the mines. So they were in clear view of all the Japanese defenders. And what they would do, here's how it was structured. They had two types of boats. One was called an LCI, a landing craft infantry, which is a type of ship with a bunch of weapons on it. Their job was to roll out about 700 yards off the beach and shoot at the beach, put down suppressing fire, prevent the Japanese from firing at their frogmen. Behind these became these speedboats, and they would go past these LCIs, these gunships that they called them. And they had five pairs of swimmers in these speedboats, and they would be dropped in pairs at 100 yards apart along the beach. And at that point, they would swim in. They were called the Naked Warriors. That's what they called us. They went in with swim trunks, a pair of fins, a mask, a knife, a slate and pencil to make maps, and blasting caps for detonating mines, which they kept in condoms to keep the powder dry. And they strapped the condoms full of these blasting caps on their belts. And in fact, so many of these condoms were used in training back in Florida that the Navy brass sent down a morals officer to look into the situation. They were wondering why all these frogmen were consuming cases and cases of condoms when other units 10 times their size weren't. So they had to explain to them that the condoms were actually a military supply, some materiel. When they went on a mission, they painted their bodies with grease that was mixed with silver paint that gave them camouflage. And what he writes was, when they got close to the beach, an awful lot of enemy fire was coming at us, and rightfully so. He rolled over in the water and looked back at all those gunboats that were supposed to be giving us cover, and they had either been sunk or disabled by Japanese fire.
Wow. So this was 3 days before the invasion.
3 days before the invasion. So they roll in with these LCIs. They're bombing the beach. These frogmen sneak in with speedboats. It's in the middle of the day. They get to the beach, and this guy turns around and looks, and these support craft are all on fire or sinking.
And just think about this. Just think about it. I mean, how in the world? You're one guy. Are these guys in teams of two?
Teams of two. So you got the buddy system, but that's it.
And how in the world do you do your job under those conditions? Broad daylight, and the enemy's firing at you, and you look back, and your support team is getting their butts handed to
them. Yeah, they're getting smoked, like your main suppressing fire. And in fact, what he writes here or says is, when the Japanese mortar shells came down in the water where they were, you know, mapping and taking samples, they actually, when they exploded, they actually popped them up almost out of the water like a cork. And they could look down in the water, and they could see, like, the shells that were missing them. They were spiraling to the bottom. But bobbing out there with the silver paint on, he claims that acted as really good camouflage. They couldn't exactly pinpoint their locations. And so after they got their sand samples and other information, they swam back to the rendezvous point with the speedboats. And going back, they said, remember, their fire suppression teams, these LCIs are blown up or most of them disabled. They're just in speedboats now. They're getting shot at and they don't know if they should just go straight and get the heck out of there or zigzag to try to avoid. And that's what they did. What's interesting is they said part of their mission that day was to get the Japanese to fire on them and to map those positions. So that way they could locate their big beach guns, which were hidden like in cliffs and hills and stuff like you described with the tunnels. Mm-hmm. And he said, we fooled them. In fact, and I didn't know this either. The Japanese thought that that was the first wave of the invasion force with these LCIs coming in. So they must have put down a lot of firepower. They thought they were the first wave of the invasion force. And that night, Tokyo Rose, which was a famous Japanese-American propagandist that would play music and say things to try to unsettle the Americans, she went on the radio and congratulated the valiant defenders of Iwo Jima for repulsing the American invasion. So they really thought that that was the invasion and they had repulsed it. But what it did force them to do is it made a mistake by firing on them because the next day, D-Day plus two, the Navy went in there and just smoked them. Now, they didn't get all the gun emplacements, right? We know, and we're going to hear about how much fighting had to take place on this well-defended island. But it did help when you could take out some of the bigger guns. And in the entire operation, the frogmen for this particular operation only lost two men. So I just want to take a little break here when he talked about, quote-unquote, the Navy SEALs and the beach obstacles and let you know what he's referring to and how brave these men were, these naked warriors painted silver going on the beaches to make the way for these invaders.
This concludes episode 5 of 8 in the Harvey Hunt series on the Warrior Next Door podcast. Join us next time for episode 6, where we hear about Harvey's experiences as he lands on Iwo Jima.
Well, thanks for joining us. If you like what you hear, please like us at the Warrior Next Door podcast Facebook page. Feel free to post your questions and we'll try to answer them in the next series of interviews that we do. All of our interviews are archived at the Veterans History Project, Library of Congress, and also with our partner at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Thanks for joining us and we'll see you next time.